Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the fourth annual St. Olaf Lecture Series, funded in part by the Minnesota's Humanities Commission. It is my privilege tonight to introduce to you Dr. Paul Bowe. Dr. Bowe is a former graduate of St. Olaf College and was the Director of Social Service Division of the ALC for 15 years before his retirement. Dr. Bowe was inside Wounded Knee, South Dakota during the Indian siege there, and was also present at the takeover of the Alexian Brothers Novitiate in Gresham, Wisconsin. For the past 3 years, Dr. Bowe and his wife have been touring the U.S. and speaking to college audiences. Dr. Bowe will speak for approximately 45 minutes, after which there will be a question and answer period. And so without any further introduction, would you please welcome Dr. Paul Bowe.
Thank you very much. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is for me to be here at St. Olaf for this interim and to have an opportunity to participate in the educational process. I don't say to teach because I'm not sure that I'm teaching, but I do feel that I am participating in the educational process, and that is a tremendous thing. Our class, which is on Native American spiritual life and the Christian church, is not present with us tonight. The 25 members of the class and my wife are up in Minneapolis tonight having an evening with an Indian spiritual leader, Philip Deer, a traditional Indian spiritual leader from Oklahoma. We chose to go up there to meet with Indian people so that we could meet them on their own ground rather than bringing them in to speak to us about their values on our turf. And I can tell you that that makes a great deal of difference to Indian people, or for that matter, to any group of people who may be a minority or may be in a weak position as over against another group of people. I told the class, however, that they wouldn't be missing anything because most of what I'm going to say we have been bringing up in class and will be bringing up in class anyway. I feel a little pressed at this point, however, because as I walked in tonight, the first person I shook hands with was President Rand. And he looked at me and he said, "Speak good tonight." I don't know whether that meant that he didn't have any confidence in my ability to speak good, or whether he meant that all St. Olaf faculty people always speak good and therefore I had to keep up the tradition, or whether he was just passing the time of the day. I really can't tell, and maybe you should ask President Rand after the meeting tonight what he really meant by that. But we'll see how it goes. The topic for this series of lectures is Native American values. I am not an Indian. I'm white, to be specific. I'm Nordic in origin, a condition thought by millions of people around the world to be superior to that of all others. Germany, for example, almost conquered Europe and maybe the rest of the world in the belief that Nordic people were superior to all other people. I come out of a Viking tradition. My wife and I had lunch at the King's Room in the center on Sunday, and I looked again at those marvelous carvings by Arne Flotten of the Vikings with the axe and the sword, pressing Christianity upon the heathen, and then on the opposite wall, the trail of the Vikings throughout all of Northern Europe and perhaps over to North America in their conquest of other people. And I come out of that tradition and many times have looked at that with some pride, as I have thought about the tradition out of which I and many of you come. I also come out of a culture, North European in origin, which, moved by a conviction, sometimes called manifest destiny, went out to conquer, civilize, and Christianize the rest of the world. I also come out of a church and a Christian tradition with a mission, a church that listened to its Lord say, "Go out and make disciples of all nations." And again he said, "Go out into the highways and the byways and compel them to come in." So coming out of all of that, I speak of Native American values with some hesitancy and fear, for I am not sure that I can speak of them except out of this root and this tradition. And perhaps that might tend to warp my thinking. Therefore, I am not tonight going to try to speak very much about Native American values. We have had Indian people already on this lecture series, and others will come. They can do this much better than I can, if they will. And sometimes they will, and sometimes they won't. I would like, therefore, to speak a little about these values, about them, and perhaps more about the place of non-Indian people, which includes most of us here tonight, in assuring that those who hold these values have the right and liberty to live by them, and in trying respectfully to understand and perhaps learn something, and maybe even grow from that understanding. I want to affirm at the outset that I believe deeply that Indian people, Native American people, do have values, vision, aspirations, strengths, and spiritual powers. In spite of centuries of misinterpretation in stories, in books, in movies, on television, and in classrooms, and I suppose most of us have been exposed to this throughout our lives. In spite of these centuries, which convince most non-Indian people that most of the negative things about them are true, or most of the negative things said about them are true, we must affirm that Indian people do have values, vision, aspirations, strengths, and spiritual powers. This is attested to by the flood, and I think it is a flood, in recent years of books, plays, photo collections, studies by scholars and others who have begun to rediscover something about Indian people which they believe must be of value. Moreover, in our own time, many Indian people are in this day rediscovering their own heritage. And this is an extremely painful process. For many Indian people have been subject to a centuries-long process of assimilation, a policy affirmed by the government, by the church, and by most people in this country. And these Indian people are in the process of recovering a lost understanding of worth and dignity, and a way of life which is worth living. I'm not going to try to explain that to you. If you've been at some of these lectures, you have heard it from the Indian people who have already been here. If you haven't understood it, there are ample books, magazines, periodicals, and sometimes even television shows which begin to open that truth up to us. Now, the understanding of these values has almost been destroyed, not just among non-Indian people, but among Indian people themselves. Several centuries, most of the history of our country, in fact, going back before the 200 years of the life of this country as a nation, there has been an exercise of power by non-Indian forces which has nearly succeeded in destroying that understanding, even among the Indians themselves. At the risk of being tiresome, I would like to say a word or two about what these forces have been and are. Individuals, individual people, whether from greed, whether from a desire for land, whether from a desire for money, or whether from a gut hatred of people who are different from themselves, or, as in many instances, out of a deluded sense of destiny, have and are still trying to destroy the spiritual and cultural values that Native American people have espoused. I have met, just in my short experience with Indian people, and it's very short, an amazing number of non-Indian people who are convinced that Indians and the values they hold are anti-American or anti-Christian and or savage and barbaric. An amazing number of people who in our very own day, many of them members of the American Lutheran Church, of which I am a pastor, hold to that belief tenaciously and attempt to exercise it in their own communities. And were there time tonight, I could give you many instances of the expressions of these people, both in words and in deeds, who are convinced that Native Americans and the values they hold are somehow the enemies of the state and of the church. There are millions of these individuals among us, and there have been down through the history of our country. Secondly, the systems by which we operate in this country, the major institutions of our society, have frequently, either knowingly or unknowingly, sought to destroy Native American values. First of all, our government. The government has held since the very beginning a policy of assimilation. It has said to Indian people, "We will leave you in peace, or at least we will accept you within limitations, if you will assimilate into our society." And almost all of the policies of the government have, for several centuries, been directed toward assimilation. In other words, of making something out of Indian people which they really are not. Policies with regard to land. Over 300 treaties have been made, and many of them either bent or broken over these several hundred years, largely over land policy. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, which was set up by the government to protect Indians and to promote their welfare, has been put under the Interior Department. The Interior Department of our country is the department which has the responsibility for managing natural resources, land, water, minerals, forests, and the like. And many Indian people have said, we are regarded, certainly by Americans, as a natural resource. The policy of education, which down through almost all of its history, has taken Indian people from their homes, transported them hundreds of miles away to government schools, there has taught them a history and a value system tailored to non-Indian America. And there denied the privilege of continuing to speak their languages, to practice their Native American customs and culture, they have largely been wiped out. Tribal government, by the act in 1934 called the Reorganization Act, was directed toward depriving Indians of their traditional means of tribal government and placing upon them a form of government very similar to that which is held by most of our municipalities, Minneapolis or St. Paul or Northfield or any other community, but which is quite alien to the tradition and value system of self-government among Indian people. And the government has, over it all, fostered a kind of dependency which has almost destroyed any sense of worth and dignity among Native American people. The church, by a mission policy, which has essentially and quite crassly put, said the Native American is a heathen, he lives in darkness, he must be converted to the light, which we will now bring him. Lest you think this is something that happened in years past, let me give you an incident which my wife and I participated in on the White Earth Reservation a year ago in northern Minnesota. We visited an Indian family there, a man whom we had known, a man of about 45 years old and his family, wife and children, in their little home. And he was quite upset. And he said to me, "Why do you Lutherans tell me that I'm going to go to hell?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean? We don't say that." And he said, "Well, just last week, a Lutheran minister from somewhere had been on the reservation and had visited in his home. Now, this man likes to drum. He likes to sing the Indian songs. He wears his hair in braids. It so happens that he is a Christian. But the Lutheran pastor, in visiting in his home, had said to him, if you don't give up all those heathenish practices, you're going to go straight to hell. And the man was extremely angry. This is in our own day. Now, the church certainly has been struggling to attempt to deal with the reconsideration of its mission policy. And yet, it has been one of those forces down through the years. Finally, community attitudes and customs. Today, we drove through the Indian area of South Minneapolis. It's largely a segregated area, populated by people who are 70% unemployed, who are basically excluded from participation in the forces that shape the life of the city of Minneapolis, even though there are nearly 16,000 Indians in Minneapolis, and who frequently live a meaningless and a very mean life in that city. These are some of the forces in the past and in the very present which have worked to destroy the understanding of Native American values and spirituality. Now, in this day, within the last decade, there has been a resurgence among Indian people of an attempt to recover a number of things. We've all been reading in the newspapers about some of the more spectacular events that have occurred around these attempts by Indian people. Behind all of those spectacular events are hundreds and hundreds of activities, events, efforts by Indian people to recover something that is precious and meaningful to them. First of all, they are attempting to recover religious concepts, a way of life based upon certain spiritual values which come out of a long and rich tradition, ceremonies, oral traditions, and disciplines. And many Christian people have looked askance at this and have felt that this is either a threat to Christianity itself, or that in some way these efforts will win Indian people who are Christians away from the Christian faith. Nonetheless, there is a strong effort among Native American people to recover a sense of their spiritual heritage. Secondly, there's a strong attempt to recover the traditional form of government, the tribal form of government along traditional lines. Many Indian people are fighting very hard for a repeal or a change of the 1934 Reorganization Act, which they feel visited upon them a form of government that is alien to the Indian tradition. Thirdly, there are strenuous efforts to either recover land which has been lost to Indian people, or to restore a land base which has been valuable and helpful to them. Many of them are, at the very least, attempting to protect what is still left to them out of a tremendous amount of land that was acknowledged to be theirs by the treaties as they were made over a period of nearly 100 years. The land is not merely an economic asset to Indian people. Land has spiritual value because Indians think spiritually in terms of space and place, as well as in terms of time and economy, as many of us seem to think. Fourthly, they are striving in the education of their children to recover some of the values which they feel were lost to several generations through exposure to government and mission schools, which sought to deprive them of these very values. Today, our class spent 2 hours at a little school in Minneapolis called Heart of the Earth. Heart of the Earth is a strenuous effort that has gone on for about 8 years under extreme difficulties by Indian people to help some of their Indian children who have not been able successfully to cope with the white school system to educate themselves in the Indian context and in the Indian tradition. And finally, many new publications, books, news sheets, poetry, music, and many others have come out of Indian people and Indian country in an effort to recover these values. Now, I want to speak finally and briefly about some thoughts on the role of non-Indian people in that struggle. First of all, it certainly is not the role of non-Indian people who may have begun to gain some understanding, who may be either driven by guilt or some other emotion, or who have a sincere desire to be of help to Indians, to try to do it for them. Indians have suffered from paternalism and helpful people for a couple of 100 years. Many Indian people are saying, it's time we began to do it for ourselves. And I don't believe that it is in place for non-Indian people in this day to attempt to do it for them. What then is the role of most of us? And I would include most of you who are here tonight, because you probably are here because you are seeking understanding or because you have a deep feeling for Indian people and their values. What is the role that we might play in dealing with Native American values? First of all, I believe to seek a greater understanding of ourselves. As non-Indian people and as a nation, which largely has been non-Indian in its shaping, to try to understand something of our history. There are plenty of books, plenty of movies, plenty of plays. We, some of us saw a television play the other night, the story of Chief Joseph and his desperate attempt to avoid annihilation by the armed forces of the United States. We can attempt to understand our history, not to get caught up in it, not to go on a guilt trip, as so many people do, not to get sentimental about the noble Indian who makes his great speech and then fades off into the sunset to be gone forever. We can get caught up in that until we think that somehow there was a noble Indian back there who just doesn't exist anymore. And therefore, the problem was that of our grandparents and has really nothing to do with us. Secondly, we can begin to deal with the present, the realities of the present. And I'd like to point out three realities that we must, all of us, must attempt to deal with if we have any concern in this area at all. The first is racism. Racism is still strong and pervasive among us. And I'm not just talking about those people someplace else. We always talk about they when we talk about racism. I'm talking about the racism that seems to be deeply ingrained in almost every one of us. It is still strong and deeply destructive. Again, I could tell you many instances which my wife and I have observed and participated in just in the last few years, which are horrible examples of the existence of racism, both within the church, within the communities which are near or adjacent to Indian people, and latently within a great many people throughout the country. Secondly, we can deal with our social and governmental institutions, which frequently are oppressive and which usually exclude Indians from the process of government or the process of operating our social institutions, or at least hold Indians back from even dealing with their own issues and their own concerns. And here must be included a re-evaluation of some of the mission concepts of the church as we look at the future and the relationship of the church, not only to Indians, but to all people who are different from most of the people of the church. We need to re-evaluate our concept of mission and the practices which have resulted from that concept. And thirdly, we can deal with laws, laws which are on the books today and which are being enforced, which are frequently detrimental and sometimes administered unjustly toward Indian people. We need to reevaluate our laws, for example, just on the as they're viewed on the basis of the policy of assimilation. Most of our laws today still have within them the power to force Indian people, unless they resist strongly, to assimilate into this, quote, melting pot, which we call America. Many Indian people, and I think non-Indian people too, who have been with them, have recognized that not only are laws often discriminatory against Indian people, but frequently they are administered unevenly, both by the police and by our courts. And you have only to read the newspapers throughout the last several years to know that the uneven application of law and order has angered and embittered a great many Indian people and has worked toward destroying their sense of worth and dignity and value. Finally, non-Indians can begin more strongly to identify with those Indian people who are in the struggle and attempt to support them in it. So many people have said to me that I'll support any Indian as long as he's a good Indian, that I love Indians. It's just the bad Indians that I don't like. And who are the bad Indians? Frequently, they are those who disagree with the policies, the procedures, and the applications of the government and of the church. I'd like to speak prominently of the church in this context. In our class recently, one of the students asked me to define my concept of what I thought the gospel was. And instead of trying to tell him what I thought the gospel was, I read him a passage from the Gospel of St. Luke, the 4th chapter, beginning with the 18th verse. You're all familiar with it. I won't have to read it here tonight. It's that passage in which Jesus comes back to the town of Nazareth, his hometown, just at the very beginning of his ministry. And he picks up the book on the rostrum, and he turns to the prophet Isaiah, and he reads those words. I have come to bring release to the captives. I have come to bring liberty to the oppressed. I have come to bring help to the poor. And I have come to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And I think it would not be stretching it to say that the total gospel the church preaches is a gospel of liberation. And you and I who are Christians know that we find freedom and liberation in living in a world in which sin is rampant and in which you and I find ourselves to be helpless sinners. That God sent his Son for our liberation. I used to think that this was just a spiritual passage, that the poor were the poor in spirit, that the oppressed were those who were oppressed by guilt, and I preached a number of sermons to that effect. I think I have come to understand that the liberation of which Jesus speaks here is the liberation of the total person in his body, his mind, his social relationships, and his spirit, if you will have it that way. Moreover, the church, down through the years, has made some noble statements. Dr. Rand, I'm sure, will remember back in 1968, at the height of some of the turmoil that was going on in our country. Black people were burning places in the cities. Young people were in revolt. And the church felt it had to address this pressing situation. And it approved a marvelous document, which I'm sure is in your library and which many of you ought to read, called Decision in a Time of National Crises. And it called upon the church, in accordance with this gospel of liberation, to stand with the poor in their struggle. It called upon the church to take risks for the sake of the liberation of the poor and the oppressed, and it called upon the church to make resources available to them. Now I'd like to read to you from a document that was put out in 1975 for our bicentennial. This is a Xerox copy. It's put out in color, so it's more attractive than this. This is a bicentennial statement of the American Lutheran Church, and I read to you the summary in part four. Thus we seize with joy the challenge of reshaping our nation in its third century. We will join forces with the powerless, the poor, the lonely, the exploited, the deprived, and the rejected. We will resist any governmental, social, economic, or ideological force which would blunt justice or demean persons. We will work with any movement, party, or institution which will help us respect all, care for all, and aim for the freedom of all. Can it be better said? Can there be a better challenge than this? This is our church speaking. In 1973, an official document of the church called Racism in the Church. Among the statements, the sin of racism expresses itself in many ways in American culture. White persons individually and their institutions are racist. Their attitudes and behavior betray their racism. Perhaps racism is harsh and blatant. Perhaps it is patronizing or perfumed in euphemisms. It may be so open and exposed that no one can miss it. It may be so subtle and covered over that only the victims feel its destructiveness. However it expresses itself, racism denies love for God, love for neighbor, and self. In its own self-interest, it goes on, the American Lutheran Church must wake up to and correct its racism. Black, brown, red, or yellow persons may not need the American Lutheran Church. The American Lutheran Church, however, needs non-white people within its membership and its leadership. Then it concludes, in the present climate of white racism in America, the American Lutheran Church has an opportunity for leadership. It can let its feathers grow, unfetter its wings, and fly wherever needed to do battle with demonic forces. Risks are great. But we must remember our Lord's experience in the temple after he read from the prophet Isaiah, Luke 4, 18 and following. We have the answer of faith that dares the impossible possibility. And so I think that one of the significant roles all of us can play is just to take to heart what we as Christians have said repeatedly, to stand with the poor in their struggle, not always to come down with our weight on the side of those forces which are oppressive, on the side of big business, on the side of big government, on the side of big law enforcement. But to take some of those risks, to grasp some of those opportunities that are all about us, to fulfill the call of our Lord to stand with those who are oppressed. Now, certainly this entails risks. First of all, the risk of re-evaluating ourselves, which can be a mighty uncomfortable thing. Secondly, it contains institutional risks. We have all known of the problems that have followed the actions of the church in even putting out statements like this. of people who have threatened to withdraw support from the church, to transfer their membership to some church more pleasing to their point of view, or even the risk of admitting some of those non-white people into positions of respect and power within the life of the church itself. It also thrusts us into the difficult process of attempting to affirm diversity and the worth and value of different kinds of peoples and cultures, while at the same time seeking to maintain our understanding of the truth and to share it in love and concern with other people. And that is a most difficult thing. In conclusion, Indians are a very small segment of our society, really inconsequential in numbers, less than 800,000. But maybe Indian people are a test for us all, a test for our nation and a test for our church, as to whether we can not only affirm in word, but whether we can affirm in the life of the country and the life of the church those concepts which we have held and spoken, but which we frequently have not carried out in our daily living. Thank you very much. If anyone would like to raise any questions or make any comments, I would be very happy to enter into a conversation and attempt to try to deal with some of these kinds of issues. They need not be confined to the material which I have enunciated here tonight, but may involve any other kind of question you may wish to ask or discuss. Yes.
What kind of things have white people done, or white individual students done, that you've been pleased with in the past? Anything?
What kind of things have students done?
Some examples you could call.
Yes. I think that the very act of this college in setting up this month, as a month with a special emphasis on Native American people, the effort and expense that the college has gone into in doing this is a very positive thing. Certainly the response of students in the classes, I think there are six classes during the interim which deal with Native Americans in one way or another, and they are well filled. I think none of them are going with small groups. There have been a number of students who have involved themselves very significantly. I'm not always happy with this, but some of them even to the point of dropping out of school for a year to devote themselves to working with Native American people, some of them at great risk. Risk of their family, anger, risk of their academic career, and sometimes even physical risk. I've known a number of students. There are some St. Olaf students who are doing this even right now at the present time. I also have appreciated the non-defensiveness of a great many students as they have attempted to wrestle with some of this. Our course is entitled Native American Values and the Christian Church, or Native American spirituality. We didn't start by examining Native American spirituality. We started by trying to look at white people, what we are like, what our institutions are like, and so on. I found that there was a remarkable lack of defensiveness and a need to assert somehow that this is okay, you just don't understand. There's been an openness and an honesty which hasn't, I don't think, been overlaid by a lot of guilt, but has really been open and honest. And I've appreciated that. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think everything is rosy with students, you know, in this area. But right off the top of my head, these are some of the things that I have felt are positive. And that applies not just to the student world. Last year in the Twin Cities, during the time of the very controversial wounded knee trials, which lasted nearly nine months, one of the longest criminal trials in the history of our country, 60 or 70 white suburbanites, mostly members of the American Lutheran Church, devoted themselves all 9 months long to being a support group, not just to the people who are on trial, but to the many hundreds of Indians who came into the city to be with their brothers and who were without. And they devoted, even though many of them had questions as to where they stood with regard to the issue at stake in the trial. And I think those are all positive signs.
Dr. Bo, how do you feel about missionary work among Indians?
How do I feel about missionary work among Indians? Well, I won't tell you how I feel about it, but I'll give you a certain number of facts that I think may help to understand it. The North Wisconsin District of the American Lutheran Church voted last spring to conduct a program which it has struggled with trying to name, but it is to be devoted to relationships between the American Lutheran Church and Native American people. There are 9 Indian reservations in the North Wisconsin area. And a large number of Indian people. I thought back to the days when I was young, and some of you who are older might remember this, when we had the Wittenberg Indian Mission. Many of our churches raised money for that from all over the country. Most of us sent clothing and blankets, and sometimes we adopted Indian children from that mission and so on. I took pains to inquire of the American Lutheran Church in the North Wisconsin District why it was launching on this program now. And after much palavering around, it was discovered that there are almost no Indian people members of the American Lutheran Church in northern Wisconsin. After having had a mission there in that area, a very aggressive mission, well supported, for I don't know how many decades. I'm sure it was at least 50 or 75 years. There are still almost no Indian members of the American Lutheran Church. Which doesn't say something about how I feel about missions, but it says something about the effectiveness of mission among Indian people. There's a great resentment right now that has been burgeoning among many Indians who, until now, have been silent and have been even participants in the church. Resentment because they feel that as they look back on their lives, that the church, in partnership with the government and with the attitudes of most non-Indian people, have participated in robbing them of something very precious, of their language, their spirituality and their culture. And the defections from the Christian churches, not just the church, the Lutheran church, but all churches among Indian people are very great. Some of them have tried to say that they're not denying Christianity, but somehow they have a deep resentment toward the church as an institution which has participated in destroying their heritage. So I think that we have to look the facts in the face, not just how we feel about it, but we have to look the facts in the face. The fact is that we have not been able, through the methods we have used in the past, to communicate very effectively the spiritual truths which we, in the understanding that we have of them. And if we want to persist in a mission effort among Indian people, then I think we must do it in an entirely different way.
If what?
In converting all Indians, would the church be pleased in this?
Well, certainly we as Christians are under the mandate of our Lord, you know, to reach out and to win all men for Christ, all people for Christ. We have that mandate. And I think that most Christians would find a deep satisfaction, yes, if that were to come about. I guess we'd have to look at that, though, and ask ourselves whether it needs to come about with the destruction of a culture and a spirituality which may have much in it which is not antithetical to the Christian, to Christianity at all, but which is just different from the way we have seen it. And I think I would gain a great deal of satisfaction if we could find ways of communicating the gospel in a way that would affirm the worth of spirituality that may have different forms of expression, but which may also center in the gospel. I don't know whether that answers your question or not. Yeah.
You're touching on your idea, it seems to me, of the universality of Christian proclamation and cultural and group diversity. I think of this in a little different way, or at least there's another issue involved, and I wonder if that isn't even more important for the Indians. And that has to do with education. I've never been able to figure out the logic of the people who run education in this country, the legislators and others. A, we're a country of plurality. Ergo, we must have a monolithic public educational system.
An educational system of homogeneity.
I jump from pluralism to the monolithic system. Now, it isn't only the Indians that suffer under it. I mean, every religious group in the country suffers under it, every ethnic group, every group that would like to have, call it, some cultural diversity. And isn't this really what they face more than anything else? You talk about this school you attended.
Right. Right. And one of the problems facing us is to try to I know when I grew up, when I was at St. Olaf here back some years ago, I believed in the melting pot concept of America. I really did. I believed in it. I thought it was just great. But we haven't got a melting pot. And somehow, we need to begin to learn to affirm diversity and provide for educational processes and other processes which will affirm it, while at the same time adhering to a core of truth that we all have to have if we're going to live together. Well, that's a neat trick if you can do it. And certainly we have not been able to among Native American people. But we do. I agree. I think we all suffer from that. One of the things that I think our class is attempting to learn is that the manifest destiny concept, the white supremacy concept, the concept of domination, is a trap not just for the peoples who are subject to it, but is a trap also for those who participate in it. And we get caught in that very trap, I think, Howard, in that homogenizing of an educational system. We're caught in our own trap.
I'm wondering how that mountain, that manifest destiny, even began, and where did we get the feeling that we have some white superiority?
Well, I'm not enough of a historian, and there are others who are here, and I think Professor Fritz may deal with that. I'm not sure what you're going to say. He's going to talk about policy toward American Indians prior to Wounded Knee. I was going to ask you whether that was Wounded Knee 1890 or 1973.
I'll leave myself some room on that.
Okay. But I would make this comment, which I don't think will destroy anything that Professor Fritz might say, and that is that both the governments in Europe as well as the church fostered actively the concept of manifest destiny. The governments, I assume, for economic reasons, and the church, out of the missionary zeal, affirmed the concept of manifest destiny, that it was the God-given destiny of Christian Northern Europe to go out to spread the government, the culture, and the light of Christianity to the people who lived in cultural, governmental, and spiritual darkness. I think the church and the governments fostered this. You can go back and read theological treatises defending that concept, governmental edicts, and the like. How it originated, I'm not sure. There must have been a multiplicity of forces, economic and spiritual, that caused it. But I firmly believe that many acts of atrocity, individual and corporate, legal and otherwise, were committed because people believed that it was their destiny under God to do this. Almost like what happened in Vietnam at a certain point when I think one of our generals said, "We're only killing those people for their own good," which is kind of another manifestation of manifest destiny. Maybe Professor Fritz will say something.
Well, try to deal with that just a little bit very quickly. I think you're right. There are a number of roots involved here. One is the Puritan idea of bringing the saving remnant of the true religion to these shores and filling the city on the hill. I think that's only one of the roots. When it came to the matter of developing a nation which was separate from Europe, I think Americans were rather desperate to have a successful democratic experiment, and at the same time, the model of great nationhood was the empire. That was an idea that was drawn from Europe, along with democratic philosophy. So they put together the two concepts. There was to be a great democratic empire. Now, in something like half a century, they had the experience of expanding their nation beyond the Appalachian Mountains, across the Mississippi, and suddenly they realized, well, we can be an empire territorial. All this continent can be ours. And it was in the 1840s that the concept of manifest destiny found expression in the pages of the New York Morning News. John L. O'Sullivan was the editor of that newspaper. He coined in the early 40s, just as the Oregon Trail was beginning to operate, America gave you a vision of what they were going to accomplish as a nation. And so they said, well, look, God has ordained us. God has given us his purpose. The witness is before us. We will become the greatest democratic nation, the greatest empire on the face of the earth. And that just proceeds of everything else they were doing in their vision of nation. Well, I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Our first speaker in this series began with the words, there Now, you've been close to some recent judicial dealings with American Indians. Would you comment on the quality of justice?
Well, I can't go along with the idea that there is no justice in America. I just don't buy that at all. I think there are serious inequities, however, in the way justice is administered. I have some very deep feelings about this, and the more you are with Indian people who are in that struggle, the more you sense it. Let me just give you an example. Some of you may have followed the recent trial in Sioux Falls of Russell Means. Now, Russell is certainly not a nice character in the usual sense. He's a very rough, tough Indian person. But Russell Means was in the courtroom back a year ago when four Indians were on trial. A number of Indian people were in the courtroom and a number were outside who couldn't get in. It happened that day that four of our bishops of the American Lutheran Church were in the courtroom. The Bishop of Iowa, Schottenhofen, Colorado, Madsen, Gilbertson, South Dakota, and Hanson in southwest Minnesota. They were there, together with a number of other churchmen. When the judge walked in, the 10 or 12 Indians refused to stand up out of respect. Now, interestingly enough, the federal judge, Nickel, in St. Paul, during the 9 months trial, never forced Indians to stand up when he came in. So there was a precedent for this in the federal court. The Indians did not stand up. The judge retired, sent his bailiff out to tell the Indians that if they didn't stand up when he came back again, they would have to suffer the consequences. The bishops took the liberty of going back into the judge's courtroom to ask him what was going on, and he warned them, "Get out of the courtroom or you will be hurt." And they said, "No, we're going to stay here." And Bishop Schlachtenhofen and Madsen got up in the front row because they wanted a better seat. The others were seated back further. The judge came in. The Indians refused to stand. The judge retired. Within 2 minutes, a squad of helmeted, flak-jacketed police with three-foot-long billy clubs moved in. Bishop Schlachtenhofen testified in court 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. Some of you read it in the newspapers. It was in the front page in the Minneapolis papers. That they moved in and immediately began to beat the defendants. Dave Hill, one of the defendants, almost lost the sight of his eye. Obviously a defenseless man sitting at the defendant's table. The squad turned to the Indians who were still seated and moved toward them with clubs upraised. They seized some chairs and a melee ensued. One of the Indians threw his chair out the window. When the window broke, the Indians outside got excited and they surged in and the police moved in on them and there was a riot. The courthouse was damaged and there was a riot. Now, both Bishop Madsen and Schlachtenhofen testified in court that they were standing there, they saw what happened, they detailed what happened, and they said the judge provoked the riot. They said it right in court. Many of you read that. The judge not only found Russell Means guilty of precipitating a riot, but he sentenced him to 4 years in prison for that act. Now, in Indian country, that move, if nothing has destroyed their faith in the justice system, that thing did. Because it wasn't just Indians testifying for Indians. Here were responsible people who were there saying this, and again, you can read it in the paper, you don't have to take my word for it, and the system grinds these people down. I have watched protesting Indians who participated at Wounded Knee, where I was present, Indians who were at Custer, who were at Pierre, who were at Gresham, and by the way, the Indians at Gresham are now under trial, right now in Juneau County in Wisconsin. All of them, without exception, are being ground down in this heavy justice system. which seems to fall so heavily on them, very adjacent to the story of Bishop Schlachtenhoffen's testimony about Russell Means and the Indians in the paper, was another story of a man in Minneapolis who had robbed a grocery store of $27,000, who, when the police were called, stole a car, started out. When the police hemmed him in, he shot 5 shots and shot out the windshield and very nearly killed one of the policemen. He was given probation. Now, those two stories stand in juxtaposition with each other on 2 columns of the Minneapolis paper a few weeks ago. I can attest to my indignancy about this, but I can say to you that these kinds of things have convinced most Indian people that there is no way justice can be achieved for Indians, especially in Indian country, you know. Now, I could recite story after story like this, but I don't think it would help. My feeling is that the justice system tends to take its cue, and I suppose this is natural, from the temper of the people, from the temper of the large majority of people. And I think, from having been with militant Indian people, aggressive Indian people, in many of the things that they have been involved with, and having seen and heard the hatred and the anger and the bitterness of the good citizens of the area, that the justice system is responsive to the feelings of the majority of people. I don't think the judges are vicious people, you know, who are out to get Indians, as much as they are responsive to the attitude of the community. That's a personal viewpoint of my own. Now, it's not only in court. I think the judgments that are made by the vast bureaucracy that governs Indians, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of the Interior, which is approving strip mining, you know, on Indian territory. You read about that if you get the Minneapolis paper again. There was a whole supplement on it just this last week. Attests to another kind of administration of justice. It's not a court administration, but it's the administration of processes of government in an unjust fashion. So I believe that there are serious inequities in our justice system. I truly believe that.
You talked before about the missionaries sort of failing in their efforts. It seems to me then that you're saying that the goal of the church is to assume its religious supremacy, maybe, and then convert, and so convert the Indians?
Well, I don't like that term, assume its religious supremacy. That seems to have some connotations that I'm not sure I can quite go along with. I think most Christians are quite convinced of the truth of the Christian faith and believe that all men would be better off were they Christians, and that they would be spiritually in tune with the truth. I'm not sure that that's religious supremacy. I don't like that kind of terminology. Well, I think, first of all, we have to examine ourselves. This is what I said in the role of non-Indian people, and it applies to the church. We have to begin to look at ourselves honestly. Where are we at? In our attitudes, in the way we apply our Christian faith? Where are we at in our understanding of the meaning of the gospel? What does that really mean? I think that's the very first step that we have to take, and it's a very positive and significant step. I've heard so many Indian people say to me, the best thing you white people can do for yourself is to go back and get your house in order. For us, is to go back and get your house in order. So that's the very first step. Once we have done that, then I think we will begin to devise the ways. I'm no mission expert. I couldn't give you a formula for doing mission among Indian people. But I think that's the first step we have to take, is a re-examination of our attitudes, our systems, and our concept of the gospel.
In terms of that Christian mandate that you're talking about,
the first one?
The Christian mandate that you're talking about, the role of missionaries,
yeah,
to convert non-Christians to Christianity. Which do you give priority, the spirituality of Indians or the Christianity of us?
I think that I would, if I were, and again, I'm just projecting and speculating. If I were in that role, I think I would try to say to myself, I'd like to find what I can respect. I'd like to approach these people with respect for them as human beings and respect for their spirituality. Respect, not acceptance of, in the sense that they're right and I'm wrong and all that kind of thing, but with respect. I think the biggest failure we have had in the mission enterprise is that we have not respected the humanity or the spiritual life that other peoples have had. Secondly, I would try to approach it from a spirit of sharing rather than a spirit of telling and saying, here's the truth and that's it. I'd like to share some spiritual insight.
How about priority? You're not answering.
I'm not sure I understand your question about priorities.
Well, you're speaking of Indian values.
Yeah.
Those values being their spiritual values. And if the church is going to contribute to Indians in terms of their values, are they going to leave their spirituality alone, or are they going to try to assimilate that spirituality?
Oh. Well, first of all, I happen to have had a little experience with Indian spirituality. A number of Indian people have kindly included me in some of their very intimate ceremonies. And I have to be honest and say that none of them have really offended my sense of the integrity of my Christian faith. In fact, I found them to be a very exhilarating experience spiritually. And I have longed for the opportunity, because I was a guest at that point, I really didn't feel that I should move in aggressively, but I have longed for the opportunity since that of sitting down with those people to share some of my perceptions in relation to their experience and to have a chance to talk that over with them. I guess I wouldn't want to try to answer your question about priorities at this point. Well, boy, that's a complicated question. Some things are compatible and some aren't. But then when I start reading Ezekiel and the book of Revelation as over against the book Black Elk Speaks, they have a remarkable sound, you know, their sound's almost the same. And I guess I don't even find that too incompatible. I have a hard time accepting some of the things that Ezekiel says, for example. I don't even understand them. You get the wheels within wheels and the winged cherubims, you know, and all of this kind of thing. when the Indians start talking about the horses galloping in from the four winds and so on, it really doesn't sound that much different. You know, I'm not about to nitpick theologically, in other words, at that point.
Many of us have been very grateful in the last year that we've had you as a representative of our church who has really stood alongside with the Indians to take the title. And I hope that somehow our appreciation comes across to you. Do you find that there is a growing sensitivity generally throughout the church and congregations among pastors and lay people and probably generally growing sensitivity to this?
Yes and no. I'd have to to answer that, I think the two forces tend to be moving, to be polarizing. There is a very good segment of the church that has a real deep concern. I've been invited to speak many, many more times than I possibly could do so. And almost always, whether it's been a workshop or a three-day workshop or an individual speech or even a month-long interim, there's been really deep concern and people have been open. That's one side of it. And I see that growing because those invitations have not ceased to come. They continue to come. On the other side, there's a very strong polarization that I can't tell whether it's political or, it's mixed up with political conservatism and so on, personified in that area by the John Birch Society, for example, which continues to hold that Indian people are evil, that they're un-American, they're communist sympathizers, they're barbaric, they're criminals. And this manifests itself very bitterly. I was in the national office just a couple weeks ago discussing some of these things with the president and a few other people in the church. And the president still says he gets 4 or 5 letters a week from people denouncing the American Lutheran Church for ever having anything to do with the American Indian Movement. Actually, the church has had nothing to do with the American Indian Movement since early 1973. And yet he gets a half a dozen letters a week from church people who are just angry and bitter, and who say that they will leave the church if the church doesn't not only stop playing footsie with militant people, not only Indians but others, but denounces them. So it's hard for me to say. You've got a really polarized situation in the church.
As Indian people begin to rejoice in
well, that's a hard one for me to answer. I've puzzled about that a great deal, and I guess I won't try to say yes or no. I prefaced my speech with a rather long statement that I come out of quite a heritage, Nordic and Viking and Christian mission and white and middle class and all the rest of it. I guess I can intellectualize about that, but I wouldn't be very honest. From my point of view, it's hard for me to understand how in this country, with its present makeup and philosophy and value system, that we can endure pockets of diversity. But Indian people are convinced that they can, and I guess I'm willing to stand with them in that conviction of theirs. I personally can't tell you how they can do it, and I sometimes has some doubts. I can only say that for a number of years, back 100 years, very expert people in this area have been predicting the demise, not only of Indian people, but the demise of Indian culture and religion. It hasn't happened. In fact, it's growing. Secondly, the survival school system, which has the enmity of the public school system and the government, is growing. And it's flourishing under tremendous odds. If I were to say, oh, they can't do it, I'm not about to say that. There's something going on that is really powerful.
And when they flourish, it's under odds.
Yeah, and I'm ready to affirm that, even though I can't philosophically, explain it.
I like everything you said, Paul, but I feel that you are pussyfooting a little bit around the Christ.
The what?
Christ, whom Christ himself claims to be the truth, and whom John so eloquently said was the light for all the nations, and whom the primitive liturgies of the church, such as the Benedictus, the Magnificat, and the Nunc Dimittis, point out to be the Christ for the oppressed in the world, you see. And I just don't quite like, maybe I'm wrong, a sort of a snidery about bringing the light to the Indians. I know it's been done wrong. I don't, I have no illusions about that. You're entirely right. But shouldn't the light be brought in the Christ?
I agree, and I really won't try to defend myself against that, Edna. I guess I find myself in some dilemma. I can say amen to everything you're saying, because I believe that.
I know you do.
But somehow, in the context of Indian relationships, being with Indian people, I spent all day today with Indian people on their territory. And somehow it seems a little different under those circumstances. And I guess if I come off that way, that's the way I am right now. Well, thank you very much. We've certainly gone around on a number of things and have raised more questions than we've had answers, but at least I hope that that's one of the functions of education.